Jenny begins her paper by saying after 40 years of independence, there are reasons to be both optimistic and pessimistic about PNG's future. You can be optimistic and you can be pessimistic because PNG is an extremely challenging environment. I'll just read a little bit more of the executive summary. A growing middle class has produced a number of talented emerging leaders who are committed to changing the weak development trajectory of their country. They will come into leadership positions in government, in the private sector, and in civil society, armed with ambitious strategic plans created by the Somare and O'Neill governments, and lessons learned from the experience of their elders. They face a highly complex set of challenges, influenced, she says, by seven key trends. Now, we'll look at each of these in turn, but those seven are weak governance, poor law and order, a failing health system, a mediocre national education system, continuing reliance on the extractive industry, the unrealised potential of PNG's subsistence agriculture, and a growing population. Jenny, on the weak governance, you say that successive Australian governments are in despair over PNG's growth trajectory. Could you explain?
Well, this comment was born out from many years of experience, both in DFAT but also talking to Australian officials and ministers over the years who've put so much effort into improving governance, in particular in Papua New Guinea. It has been a big theme of the last three governments in Australia, a big theme of the aid program, and we're still seeing not very much improvement. Now, I should clarify that by saying we're not seeing very much improvement in the Western sense of governance. So we are holding Papua New Guinea to Australian standards of governance. As you pointed out in your book, I think we did introduce the Westminster system to Papua New Guinea, and perhaps it is not the most ideal system for our nearest neighbour. So they do unfortunately suffer from being held to our standards, but unfortunately, that's just the way it's come about, and I think there's not only Australian politicians and officials, but a lot of young Papua New Guineans who are despairing of corruption in Papua New Guinea and what can be done to resolve those issues.
Yeah, you say about one third of the aid goes to governance issues, and there hasn't been much of a return.
Yeah, that's right. So in my paper, I also quote some World Bank study into various elements of governance that unfortunately shows a very bad record, particularly in control of corruption, the rule of law. But I think, you know, there's certainly hope to turn that around. And as I point out in my paper, this young population is very engaged in trying to turn that around. And maybe there is room to find a new system for Papua New Guinea that does deliver better governance and the governance that the people expect.
What do you think are some of the contributing causes to corruption?
there are many. The resources industry, for a start, has to be one of them. If Papua New Guinea didn't have that huge resources endowment and the investment that it gets from foreign companies into that sector, there simply wouldn't be the revenue to go around and to be the inspiration for the corruption. Of course, that's not the only story, the sort of development of a big man culture, I think, where Papua New Guinean leaders wanted to be seen to be delivering on expectations and not having a system of government that they can rely on to deliver on those expectations, particularly in essential services, and needing to really raise more money themselves to do that. So we talk about corruption as an evil, but in many cases it is simply a matter of politicians trying to raise their own funds, not in ideal means, to deliver development to their people.
You say Peter O'Neill is now in a very powerful position, that in current day PNG, prime ministers have assumed considerable power. Now, I think I know one of the reasons for that, but it is interesting to me that since 2007, while Australia has had five prime ministers, Papua New Guinea has just had two. So maybe the political stability is more on one side than the other. But yes, could you go on about that issue of being in a powerful position now, the PNG prime minister?
Yeah, well, there are a few reasons for that. Back when Makary Murata was the Prime Minister, he came in after a long period of very frequent changes of Prime Minister that you'll be familiar with reporting on over your time there. Papua New Guinea was famous for its political instability, and during Murata's time, the government introduced a political parties integrity bill, which essentially stopped members of parliament from crossing the floor, changing parties and voting motions of no confidence in the prime minister. So everyone at the time thought this was great, it would deliver stability, and in fact it has. It's delivered a lot of stability for the prime minister. And since that time, we've seen Michael Somare hold power for a very long period of time, and now O'Neill for getting up to be a similar amount of time. O'Neill's taken it, I guess, one step further with expanding his District Services Improvement Program, which is a system of grants that are given to members of Parliament, essentially to develop their own constituencies. And we've seen over the last couple of years that expand even into responsibility in the Parliament, with a member of the opposition recently asking the Minister for Health what was happening with health services in his constituency, and the Health Minister turned it back on him and said, well, you've got your constituent funding, it's your problem. And I can't imagine us ever seeing that in Australia, a question being asked of the Health Minister in the Australian Parliament, what's going on in my constituency, and the responsibility being shunted back home to the Member of Parliament. So this is a real change where O'Neill is able to sort of put responsibility back onto Members of Parliament, and therefore, I guess, avoid some accountability for the lack of delivery at the centre. And through these funds, ensure loyalty from the MPs, because as long as they're getting their grants, they're likely to vote for him and not vote against him.
In Australian dollar terms, it's about $7.5 million a year that each of the members gets. What's the result?
I think if you asked the average Papua New Guinean, you'd find them hard pressed to show the results. That, of course, is not across the board. There are a few good MPs who are doing good things, as we've seen in other countries in Melanesia with those constituency funds. And similarly, there's a lot of pressure, just as there is on the national government, on those local MPs to find a system that will deliver adequate health and education and other essential services. Because you can imagine, with 89 districts, it's very difficult for individual MPs to find out how they do that efficiently with limited resources and limited expertise.
The second of your seven areas of concern is law and order. Could you talk about that for a little?
Well, law and order, as I'm sure everyone here will be pretty familiar with in Papua New Guinea, is pretty bad. And in fact, it's a real block, I think, for many areas of development. Tourism is a key one that it's a block for. You often tell a joke, I think, about being in a tourism office, I think, here, and about people waiting in the office telling prospective visitors not to stop in Port Moresby and to go on out of the capital. And I think that says a lot, the law and order problems in particularly in Port Moresby and in Lae, the second city, are a real disincentive for visitors, but also importantly for business, for investors, and for the growth of local and small to medium business enterprises. The law and order environment in PNG disadvantages women in particular. They are more often the victims of crime and find it harder to get legal redress for their problems.
And the police force is pretty small for the population, but it's also had lots of problems too, hasn't it?
Yeah, so it is small by global standards per head of population, the Somare government made a commitment to expand the size of the force, and the O'Neill government has backed that up too. But I think even if we did see those ambitions for increasing the size of the force realised, the problems, the inherent problems in the performance of the force will not go away with that. We've seen revolving leadership within the position of the police commissioner. It's probably a more unstable position to be in than the Prime Minister of Australia. Without that strong leadership from the top, without the investment in training and indeed in pay, police officers are paid very poorly, which increases the incentive for them to take illegal payments and not do their job properly.
The third area, you say, is a failing health system, and one of the statistics that struck me was that only 51 of the 400 doctors in PNG actually are outside the capital.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, this is something we learned recently at the Lowe Institute. As you know, we host this annual Australia PNG Emerging Leaders Dialogue, and some of our alumni from that dialogue are here tonight. At last year's dialogue, we had a rural doctor who told us she was one of only four doctors who actually worked in the rural areas, so that the 51 who don't work in urban areas work in rural centres, so big towns in rural areas, but there are very, very few doctors who actually work in the remotest of areas, and strangely enough, in the very highly populated areas of the Highlands, there are very few doctors.
A mediocre education system.
Yeah, education is a topic that every single event that we have done on Papua New Guinea here in the 8 years that I've been here, no matter what our major theme is, and it's often foreign policy or themes around the future or emerging leaders, it always comes back to education. Every Papua New Guinean participant in the event will always raise problems with education, dissatisfaction with education standards. Business will often raise the lack of matching between their expectations of what they want their recruits to be doing and what kind of training is available in Papua New Guinea, both at university level and other parts of the tertiary sector. And as we know, it's problematic throughout the system. We've seen review after review find problems in the system. That's not to say that there aren't good teachers and good professors and people capable of getting themselves a good education. Of course, that happens, and obviously there's a large number of educated people in Papua New Guinea now. But the problem is the whole system doesn't deliver. So we're seeing large numbers of young children go through the school system. And to his credit, Peter O'Neill's introduction of a free education policy has meant that we're seeing more people and more kids go through primary school. But that's right, and he's very proud of that, and I think that is a really important point to make. But what the government hasn't done is sequence that policy with teachers, so sort of open the schools to everyone to attend, but hasn't provided enough teachers or qualified teachers to be delivering on that education policy.
Yeah, some of the classes I hear are up to 70 children per classroom. Makes it extremely difficult for teachers. University places too, there aren't a lot in PNG.
That's right, and not many universities. And something else the O'Neill government is trying to do is establish another university. Papua New Guineans also, because they're not part of the rest of the region's university system, can't go to USP as a matter of right. So they are limited to the universities in Papua New Guinea and then studying in Australia if they can, or getting scholarships at postgraduate level. So they really are starved for places, and that's been especially evident this year.
One of the current problems with the PNG economy is the collapse in commodity prices, and you talk about an over-reliance on the extractive industries. Could you elaborate on that?
So the extractive industries, I should say I'm not a detractor from the importance of the resources industry. It's clearly vital for Papua New Guinea and has delivered revenue that simply is sort of not possible in other countries in the region. Solomons and Vanuatu, for example, don't have anywhere near the same opportunities that Papua New Guinea has because of that, the revenue they get from resources. But it has, because of the sort of boom-bust cycle that's common in that sector and problem in this country too, we've seen Papua New Guinea, the government, rely on those very high prices at the time that they're high and spend the money in advance of actually getting it. Then coming down when the prices come down and finding they can't actually deliver on what they promised. So it's kind of disappointing that, after a proven cycle, of high prices and low prices, the PNG government doesn't really plan on this, plan contingencies for this, as some other countries are better at doing. So, look, revenue from the resources industry is going to continue to be very important for Papua New Guinea over the next 50 to 100 years. They have a very important endowment there. But over-relying on it and relying on it to carry them through the highs and the lows is not the way to go, particularly when they have such abundant food sources. Agriculture is drastically underdeveloped and could deliver so much more for PNG, even if not in terms of revenue flowing into the country, in terms of internal trade and helping the growth of small business.
Yeah, that takes us on to the next point, which is the fact that subsistence agriculture, although it feeds enormous numbers of people, you believe that more could be done.
Yeah, so Papua New Guinea is very lucky, in contrast to countries of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, or South Asia, has abundant food sources, and the majority of the population basically can feed themselves without needing to buy food at the store as we do here in Australia. So it's one blessing that Papua New Guinea has. Unfortunately, in times of drought, as we're seeing at the moment again, that blessing sometimes fails and other means have to be found. But overall, over the sort of the long-term view, subsistence is vital to the country. But in the past, we've seen, and this is something, again, I've learned from my time here and talking to emerging leaders, in the past there have been a lot of successes with sort of small agricultural holdings and farmers in remote rural areas making significant cash out of coffee exports and trading in other crops. So I think, you know, what has been lost over the last 40 years has been a sort of failure to invest in the infrastructure that you need to trade cash crops. There's been a lack of investment in electricity, for example, that has also failed to develop areas that could trade. Lack of investment in roads and transport hubs that enable all those things to happen. So it's been, I guess, the most disappointing thing for the rural majority is that they haven't seen their own abilities recognised, and so much of the revenue from resources industry has been refocused back into the capital, building infrastructure in the capital.
The seventh point you make is that although there is this ability for subsistence agriculture at the moment to feed the majority of the people, a growing population is a real worry.
Growing population will certainly put pressure on the subsistence system, put pressure on education, of course, which is already struggling to meet demand. It will put pressure on health, again, struggling to deliver to the existing population. There are some estimates that the population of Papua New Guinea could be 30 million by 2050, and that's higher than Australia's population is right now, and I think really anyone in Australia has thought through what that might mean. And without significant new and broader sort of investment across the economic sectors of Papua New Guinea, I think it's going to be a huge challenge. Having said all that, a growing young population can be a really important boon for a developing country, and it's certainly better than having an ageing population. So there's a lot of opportunity there.
You say that without a serious effort to reverse some or all of these negative trends we've just been speaking about and make more of the positive ones, PNG's future looks bleak. It's not just that each of these trends will have a negative impact on the country, but these tend to be mutually reinforcing.
Yes. So basically, I'm arguing that they all feed into each other. So poor law and order dissuades foreign investors sort of outside the resources sector. It dissuades young people from starting up businesses. It stops teachers from going to rural schools where their security can't be guaranteed. It hurts women disproportionately and prevents them from contributing fully to the economy. Poor health, of course, means that people aren't at their fittest for the majority of their lives and therefore can't make a meaningful contribution to the economy. Poor education system means that people aren't getting the skills they need to either work in the formal sector or develop their own business in businesses in the rural sector. So all these trends, and unfortunately most of them are either negative or certainly not going in a positive direction, reinforce each other and don't offer a lot of reason for hope unless you can break through one of them.
Now, you've got some suggestions about what these future leaders should do. Could we look at a few of those? I mean, one is you're suggesting that the educational investment should be narrowed down in a way.
Yeah, so this is an area I've struggled with because there is so much debate and indeed division on what to do about education in Papua New Guinea, and so many different attempts have been tried at ways of, at improving it. But I've looked at in the paper at things that have worked in Papua New Guinea's history, both in contemporary Papua New Guinea and in the history of PNG. One thing that has worked in contemporary PNG is in Enga province, where there's been a very substantial investment from the provincial government in education, so much so that we're now hearing UPNG being talked about as the Engan University because all the students there are basically graduates from Enga schools. They've had a governor there who's been very focused on investing in education and I'm not sure how much this has been at the expense of other development, but this sort of singular focus on improving the standard of education, improving the quality, and making sure that students carry on to university or other training, I think has done a huge service to Enga in the immediate term. So it does show that a single-minded focus on improving quality can work. I've also drawn on another example from PNG's history. Time of independence, I think there were four national high schools which drew kind of the best and the brightest from all over PNG and brought them to study in four national high schools where they sort of worked together and acted collectively and basically built the nation. And there's a lot of support amongst sort of the older generation and some of the younger generation for a return to this kind of system where you bring people together rather than having them educated in different centres and not get to know each other and therefore perhaps not contribute to the continual building of the nation.
You make a suggestion about pouring investment into greater electrification and communications. Could you explain that one?
So we've seen huge advances in Papua New Guinea in the last decade in telecommunications with the advent of mobile phone availability. Amanda Watson in front row there is a particular expert in this sector, but the introduction of the company Digicel, which has done so much to expand mobile phone coverage in the region and particularly in Papua New Guinea, has meant that more than half the population of Papua New Guinea, I think it's close on 80% now, is connected via mobile phone. And this has just made such a difference to many areas of life. But what is lacking is electrification. So we are seeing people connected, but having them sort of able to do business, study, and engage, more fully in modern life is constrained by the very low access to electricity, which is currently under 20% of the population have access to electricity. So and those that do have it are mostly in urban centres. So I think it's really important to focus on the remoter areas of high population where they're in desperate need of both more telecommunications, broadband services and electricity, which could act as a circuit breaker.
Finally, from me, you suggest tailored law and order issues.
Yeah, so law and order is such a huge problem in PNG that it's really hard to know where to start, and I wouldn't presume to tell any Papua New Guinean how to solve the immense problem that there is there. So what I've looked at is some examples that have worked in other countries of very high crime, where certain hotspots and very high crime areas have been targeted with a lot of resources, not just policing services, but using private security forces as well to beef that up, providing better access to courts, providing safe houses for women who suffer from domestic violence, and addressing the root causes of crime, so helping rehabilitate criminals and looking more closely at the system in a holistic way. So what I've suggested is that this could be trialled in one high crime area, such as Lae, for example, where you could prove the benefits of that kind of approach and then perhaps expand it sort of more broadly. It's really hard to know just where to start at the moment.
Certainly is. I'd like to throw this open now to questions from the audience. If you could put your hand up and just wait until the microphone gets to you and tell us who you are and then throw the question at Jenny and I'll duck off.
Thank you, Amanda Watson. I wasn't clear on your suggestion about education. If you could explain that a bit more, please.
Sure. So, like my other suggestions, I'm not suggesting a revolution or a completely different system, but focusing on what works. So, we know that the Enga focus on education works. So, perhaps getting some other provinces to trial that kind of approach and see if it is, maybe it's not just an Enga specialty, maybe it will work in other provinces. So targeting attention on what has worked. And I think Papua New Guinea often is pressured by Australia and others to look for examples from outside the country, and they forget to look at the successes they've had from within. Similarly for the National High Schools program, I think many things that have gone wrong with leadership in Papua New Guinea could be attributable to the fact that we've lost that sort of collective leadership that was engendered through the National High School system. So reinvesting in a system like that might be a very smart move for the future. May not deliver sort of the kind of results that we want to see immediately, but certainly over the long term has potential.
Do you see a role for Australian aid in perhaps helping teachers, Australian teachers, go and teach in
Papua New Guinea? Yeah, so Sean, as you probably know, this has been raised by several prime ministers of Papua New Guinea over the years. I think almost everyone in our lifetime. I think there's certainly a lot of potential there, and in terms of making up a gap in training at the moment and not having enough teachers, getting more teachers in from abroad, that already happens in the university sector, of course, but doing that at a high school level could help.
Shortly after Prime Minister O'Neill took office...
Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, introduce myself, sorry. I'm Jemima Garrett from the ABC and Radio Australia. Shortly after Prime Minister O'Neill took office, he talked big on making the public service more efficient. I was just wondering if anything happened, and if so, what, and what came of that. And secondly, the Australian Government's new governance centre, what's your assessment of how that'll work and what the strengths and weaknesses of that idea and that, you know, what it'll be doing?
On the efficiency question, this is something that Prime Minister O'Neill has been very engaged in, and it kind of almost stands in contrast to his desire to kick foreign advisers out who were supposed to be there to increase efficiency. But what he has done is tried to get more training facilities available, and that goes to the governance facility, which I'll talk about in a minute. But he's also turned to the private sector on quite a few occasions to get sort of expertise from the private sector in to sort of sit inside government ministries and to help those ministries do their job better. Has it been working? I think it depends on the ministry. I have heard some success stories. Most of my information is from the private sector side, I guess, who say that, you know, that they feel they're under pressure to kind of almost do the job for the public servants, and they're not sure how. And when I say private sector, I mean private sector in Papua New Guinea, not advisors from Australia. But I think it's an important stopgap measure. You know, I think everything has to be tried, and O'Neill's certainly trying a lot of things. And it's an important part of the learning process, trial and error, and see what works. But I think, you know, the broader assessment of most Papua New Guineans is that the public service has a long way to go, that it's still very weak, and that capacity is extraordinarily weak, and is not going to improve quickly enough to deliver on the expectations of the population. On the governance sector, this is a new initiative by the Australian government and a personal interest of the foreign ministers, and I know her ambition is to reinvigorate the public service and I guess university and the business sector with this. And I think it's a very ambitious plan. It harks back to some previous initiatives in Papua New Guinea's history as well, in terms of public sector training. So it's definitely, I think, a good initiative. It's a very expensive one. And it will be, you know, there'll be a lot of attention on it just to see whether it works. I'm not sure. It's still at an early stage, but I'm not sure there's yet kind of enough commitment and dedication on the PNG side in terms of putting their own resources into it to guarantee a success. But I'm sure Australia will do its utmost to make sure it is, because it is a personal interest of the ministers.
Question.
Sorry, Andrea Williams. You mentioned about training of the public service in the past, and I don't know how many people here are, you know, you probably all are aware of ASOPA, which was at Mosman. Rather than sending the money to Papua New Guinea, would it be good for the Australian government to welcome Papua New Guineans here in Australia and setting up a centre here that could help train and go back from there?
I don't want to speak for the Australian government because I don't know what's in their head, but I think certainly preference of our government over the last decade, or possibly even further back than that, is to get away from bringing lots of Papua New Guineans to Australia and focus on training and education, certainly, you know, building up universities there rather than have everyone come here in terms of... And I think they see that as important in terms of nation building, perhaps not as valuable in terms of the bilateral relationship and people-to-people relations, Andrea, but this is just kind of how aid is delivered globally, that it's important to build up the host country rather than have a sort of a continual reliance on foreigners. Yeah, look, I agree, and I think, you know, a lot more can be done in the paper. I suggest that we open scholarship places for Papua New Guineans at undergrad level. At the moment, those places are only open at postgraduate level. Now, a lot more Papua New Guineans do come at undergraduate level and come and study in Australian high schools still, but of course at their family's expense. Offering a bit of a vow to the PNG University system, which is under incredible strain, to have students come here under scholarship, I think would be a good start for that, and perhaps could be extended to other areas as well.
In my paper, I suggest that this governance precinct that Julie Bishop is pushing the money towards is almost an attempt to re-establish a SOPA, but in Port Moresby.
David Lees, Royal United Services Institute. We did, over the last few years, we've been thinking of a positive future for PNG, independent, supported by its resources, with a focus on Asia, whereas for the rest of Melanesia, the Southwest Pacific, it's been much more of a dependence culture, focused much more on Australia and New Zealand and perhaps France. Was that premature to come to that sort of judgment? Where do you see us going over the next 20 to 30 years? Where do you see PNG going in that regard?
In terms of its international profile?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
I think Papua New Guinea, despite the sort of the talents of Fiji in getting its name on the international agenda, Papua New Guinea still has the far better chance of being an important country in East Asia. And I think that's been a large part of its success in certainly in development of resources over the last decade, is to attract that investment from not only from China but from other countries in East Asia, and developing really solid links that are not Australia dependent and not aid dependent. Although Papua New Guinea is Australia's largest aid recipient, Papua New Guinea is by no means dependent on aid. It's a very small proportion of their overall budget. And yes, Papua New Guinea's interests are very much in East Asia, and they happily now no longer remote from the global centre of economic power because it's moved closer to them, to East Asia. So, and that's definitely a positive for PNG's future, that the growth that we're seeing in East Asia and Papua New Guinea's ability to take advantage of that into the future. And I think that's something that will benefit the next generation of leaders, having options, so not just having to depend on aid or on Australia.
Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute. Thanks for the great presentation, Jenny. Seems like one of the major challenges for policy in PNG is just the sequencing of policy. I mean, there's always the grand vision, the proclamation, but the lack of really thinking through the actual implementation. And, you know, examples are, you know, the tuition-free, fee-free policy before you have the teachers to actually teach these students or the schools to actually house the students, or the decentralisation of funding before you have the accountability mechanism set up to actually monitor that spending at the provincial and district level, or the hosting of APEC in 2018. How much is that to blame of the international community? I mean, look at the MDGs where we set an explicit goal where we have to have every child educated, or from the Australian government or from our aid program where we set expectations on a three-year cycle, not a generational cycle. So is it just the PNG government to blame, or do we need to take some of this blame upon ourselves and the expectations we set upon, and unrealistic expectations we set upon the government?
Yeah, PNG? That's a really good question. Again, something that I've learned over our time here, that we put a lot of expectations on Papua New Guinea, both in terms of what we expect in terms of returns from the aid program, in terms of Australian businesses putting pressure on them to deliver on investments and to provide the right regulatory environment and the tax breaks and get all the policy lined up. So that there's pressure from, and that's just Australia, there's also pressure, of course, from other countries that are investing in Papua New Guinea. And I certainly think the expectations that we put on them, put on Papua New Guinea politicians and officials to kind of live up to our standards, or to work almost in an Australian system when the Australian system just simply doesn't exist there. Sean talks in his book about just the variety of language groups and cultures and the difficulty of governing such a diverse country and topographically complex country. And I think Sean makes a joke, I'm not sure if it's in his paper or not, or just in the presentations around it, that Australian politicians would be horrified if they were thrust into being an MP in Papua New Guinea. So, yeah, I do think that the expectations are a problem. The three-year electoral cycle and constant change in the aid program that we see, changing of goalposts, changing of program objectives, and I'm continually amazed to see the PNG government say we want a program more aligned to our objectives, the aid program that is, and the Australian government saying yes, well, that's what we want too, and they seem to have the same discussion every 3 years. And I'm not sure where this alignment is going, because they keep complaining every time there's a change of government, program's not aligned to each other. So I think there's a long way to go on how the Australian government perceives what Papua New Guinea is capable of doing, and how we can work better with their system and what they're capable of. And this is not at all to disparage the PNG system, but just to acknowledge that they're at a completely different place to we are, and the complexity of their challenges is really far greater than ours is. I often think, looking at the state of our Indigenous policy here in Australia and how poorly we do at delivering services to remote areas, and then we're holding PNG up to a standard, you know, as we would be delivering services in Sydney rather than in Alice Springs or somewhere even more remote. So I think that there is definitely a mismatch between expectations and how we go about putting pressure on Papua New Guinea to deliver on them, and certainly we could reflect on that a lot more and change that approach.
Lachlan from SAGO Network. Jenny, thanks for your thoughts tonight and for your work over recent years with the Emerging Leaders Dialogue. That's certainly benefited many of us here in this room and in PNG. The question I'd like to pose to you, and forgive me if it's a controversial one, but I'm wondering what your thoughts might be on whether the Australian Detention Centre in Manus Island might change the relationship between the Australian and PNG governments, and whether if that's sustained over a long period of time, whether that might actually hamstring, or perhaps already hamstrings, Australia's ability to comment or encourage PNG toward further advances regarding issues such as transparency.
Thanks, Lachlan. It is a controversial question, but one I'm happy to answer. It definitely has changed the relationship. One thing I often say in answer to this question, and I've had it a lot, is that I think it probably would have changed a bit anyway. Julie Bishop's approach to relationships with the region is quite different to that of her predecessors. She's very much interested in working with counterparts on an equal level, trying to move away from that aid donor, aid client relationship that has characterised Australia's relations with Papua New Guinea and the region in the past. So I think that kind of open criticism that we've seen from Australian foreign ministers in the past of issues like corruption and poor governance in Papua New Guinea, we were probably not going to see from Julie Bishop. I think she definitely does have a different approach. But the Asylum Seekers Centre and our dependence on Papua New Guinea to keep that centre running as a deterrent to irregular migration, I think is the term that's used now, to Australia is certainly changing the nature of how we relate, and importantly changing the perception. So whatever is the reality, so whatever Australian officials will tell you about, you know, the issues are kept separate, the perception is that everything is related. I attended the press club address by Peter O'Neill in Canberra a couple of weeks ago, and he was openly critical in the lecture about the Asylum Seeker Centre and said, look, we in Papua New Guinea, we can't deliver on this. We can't resettle refugees. It's beyond our capacity. But yet that's what he agreed to, and that's the line that the Australian government keeps giving, that refugees will be resettled in Papua New Guinea. And here we have the Prime Minister in Canberra saying it's never going to happen. So I think there are a lot of problems around that issue, and I think it will continue to be a sore on the bilateral relationship going forward. I would hope that it doesn't overshadow it completely. I think there's a lot of depth to the relationship, and happily, increasingly more depth to the people-to-people relationship and business-to-business relationship. So we're not solely dependent on that issue governing everything, but it's certainly problematic.
Yeah, my wife is from Manus, and she's not happy about the depiction of Manus as being Hellhole Island in some sections of the Australian media. One final question, anyone?
Kirk Huffman, honorary curator at the National Museum of the Vanuatu Cultural Centre. Can I just throw in a sort of rural view from Vanuatu about PNG? It's got some points that either Sean or Jenny might want to comment on. Big fella bugger island, good fella man or good fella woman? Look, it's close enough to talk pigeon.
yeah.
Or big fella man or big fella Mary, woman. Or brother or sister blue yumi from Vanuatu. B, he got two or three problem. First something, only no promote them good old chief more custom governments.
Long Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, only go too much low road blow white man. Mm. Number two something, only cast some sick blong money. Money, he got one sick blow him, only cast some finish. Sorry, too much law getter. Number three something, me fairly no understand good from what him now, only no talk about West Papua. From him, he close up no other place blow getter. No, two or brother, more sister blow or getter, more uni.
On the final issue, it's a lot easier to be in Port Vila than in Port Moresby. Vanuatu doesn't have a 750-kilometre border with Indonesia, and I think it's constantly on the mind of people in governance in PNG. Not so much now, but certainly in the past, the expectation that all of a sudden there could be a lot more trouble caused by Indonesia along that border and into PNG has constrained PNG's criticism. But Peter O'Neill has come out talking about the human rights issues of West Papua and Papua. But I don't think you're going to find any PNG government taking on Indonesia and openly promoting independence for the other half of the main island there. Jenny, do you have...
Yeah, I think Peter O'Neill probably went as far as he could last year in talking at making human rights in West Papua the issue. He was in actually addressed the Law Institute last year, and we had a talk about that. And he told me he was being hammered on Facebook about it. That's what he was responding to. So there's certainly a lot of popular support for West Papuan independence amongst young people in Papua New Guinea, and that was very effective in terms of getting the Prime Minister to say something, and then did what he did in the Melanesian Spearhead Group with getting some kind of recognition, observer status, I think. So, but I think I agree with Sean. I think that's about as far as he can go.
On the other two issues, Kirk, the chiefly system, certainly there were problems in PNG relative to how it seems to operate fairly well in Vanuatu. And we've got a situation back in my wife's village now where the chief has just died, and there's a bit of discussion about what does happen now and who should be in charge. Pauline's brother should now be the paramount chief of that particular area, but it's a very complicated issue because people have migrated from southern Manus into their area. And on the third issue about the sickness, money sickness, I think one of the problems in PNG is exactly that. There's a bit of money sickness around.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have time for this evening. Thank you, Jenny, and thank you, Sean, for a wonderful discussion, wonderful conversation. Sean, you're pretty good at this interviewing thing. Tonight has a dual purpose, though. One was to launch Jenny's paper, but the other purpose is to farewell Jenny, who's finishing with us this week at the Lowy Institute. And to do that job, I'd like to invite our Executive Director, Dr. Michael Fullilove, to say a few words.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you, Sean and Jenny, for a great conversation. Both Sean and Jenny have recently published papers with us. Sean's magnificent Lowy Institute paper, The Embarrassed Colonialist, and now Jenny's paper that we're launching today. And both of them deserve congratulations for those important papers. So it's a happy occasion, but it's also a sad occasion because Jenny is leaving us after 8 years with the Institute to move with her family to Devon. And over the last 8 years, Jenny has made an enormous contribution to the Institute and to the national debate on these issues. I'm proud to say but I talent spotted Jenny in a cafe in Ankara about 9 years ago when she was the deputy chief of mission in Turkey, and for her sins she had to accompany me to a day of meetings in Ankara, and over coffee I learned that her passion really was the Pacific, and so I was able to recommend her to my predecessor Alan Gingell as somebody who could head up our new Melanesia program. It can be dangerous having coffee with me, as I said to the colleagues today, because you never know, one day you're in Ankara and the next minute you're in Sydney. Over those 8 years, Jenny has been a wonderful colleague. She's smart, she's committed, she's loyal, she's a believer, she's a contributor, she's a mentor to younger scholars. There's been a whole generation of young people who've come through Jenny's program and gone on to great things. Anthony suggested today with the colleagues that we should call them the Jennies. She was a pioneer, as Anthony also mentioned. She was, I think, the first female researcher appointed to the Lowy Institute, and now due to the efforts of a lot of people, not least her, there are many, many women at the Institute, and it's something we're very proud of, that we're a diverse institution in a field that is not so diverse. So I think of her as sort of Wonder Woman, in the invisible jet flying around Melanesia, making an enormous contribution, and that contribution is not limited in any way to the Institute. She's in her period here, she has not just built a program, but she's prodded governments, she's drawn their fire on occasion, she's drawn their praise. She's good at raising money, which as an executive director you like. She has influenced policy. She's become a very powerful voice in the debate. And she leaves a magnificent legacy. She has thickened the discussion in this country about the region. And often I say the Lowy Institute is irreplaceable, I think, to the Australian foreign policy debate. And if that's the case, I think that the Institute and the program is also irreplaceable to the debate in Australia on Melanesia. Jenny herself and with her colleagues has contributed to our discussion of so many Melanesian countries, all of them really, but I think it's right and it's appropriate that her final paper is on Papua New Guinea, because that's the country that is most important in the region. It's the country probably also where Jenny has made the biggest impact, and I think the emerging leaders discussion that was mentioned by one of the questioners, I think, is a lasting human legacy. I mean, there's a legacy of lots of reports, but there's a legacy of lots of human beings who've been influenced by Jenny, and in particular that program of bringing together young Papua New Guineans and young Australians is really a wonderful thing that she leaves to the rest of us, and we certainly continue, certainly intend to continue her legacy with Jonathan and Anna and Alistair and Chloe and Anthony and myself and everybody else. We're very determined to continue Jenny's legacy. We'll be helped in that endeavour by the fact that she has agreed, to my delight, to be a non-resident fellow at the Institute. So she'll continue her contributions from the other side of the world. But we know that most of her efforts now will be focused on her new life with Jason and Xavier and Mimi in deepest, darkest Devon, which is the only part of the world more remote and mysterious than the highlands of PNG. Luckily, she doesn't go to Devon as a stranger. Jason's family is big in Devon, and he's a big man in that part of the world. But Jenny doesn't, you know, really believe in the big man culture. So she'll be bringing her focus on governance and education and other issues to Devon. I think Jenny's folks are also here, is that right? So welcome. I think this is your first Lowy Institute event. Is that right? Well, you've come to a great one. I just want to say, Jenny, we will miss you. We're very proud of you. We're very grateful to you, to everything you've done. And I think that we have some flowers. Thank you very much, Andrew. I know you've only got a week or so to enjoy them, but so, ladies and gentlemen, please join us. I don't think, is there anything else you need to do, Anthony? If not, we have some wine and some drinks and some food coming out. So please stick around, have a drink with us, and please take the opportunity to thank Jenny for everything she's done at the Institute and to wish her and Jason and Xavier and Mimi bon voyage.